Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Now, Health Matters, presented by SSM Health. Here's your host, KMOX Health Editor, Fred Bottomer.
Hi there, and thanks for joining us again. I really do appreciate it. Hope you're having a great weekend. Lots to talk about over the next hour, including an in-depth look at coronavirus. We'll get some answers to the questions many of us are asking. We'll also find out about accidental poisonings in kids, with a special warning to parents and grandparents. But first, let's start this week's show the way we do every week with our co-host, Dr. Fred Buchhold. Dr. Buchhold is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchhold, thanks for joining us again.
Glad to be here.
The FDA this past week has approved a new non-statin drug to treat high cholesterol. Tell us about it.
Again, this is another drug that's meant to reduce cholesterol. We call it lipid is the other name we use for this, presumably to treat coronary artery disease or heart disease. Cholesterol is kind of one of these markers we use to kind of assess for risk of cardiovascular disease. So the theory or the fact that the higher it is, the more likely you are to have heart disease led to the initial treatment of this, which were what we call statins. So if you think about atorvastatin, which is Lipitor, or simvastatin, which is Ocor, and a number of other drugs, they've been out in the market, so to speak, for a long time now, and drugs were very used to prescribe and give to either prevent heart disease, or if you were to have a heart attack or known to have heart disease, we used to treat it. And the benefit of those drugs, the theory behind them was that by reducing cholesterol, that they reduce the chances of you having another heart attack or dying from a heart attack. And that's basically what's happened. And these are pretty common medicines now, and they've had a huge effect. But there's a subset of people that are on the highest doses we can give them that still have high cholesterol. And so there's still a search to find drugs that reduce cholesterol more. It's kind of an interesting thing if you look at statin use and how it works. A couple of things that have kind of started to become more into the accepted mantra of practice. One is they work kind of regardless of whether or not they reduce your cholesterol. The more they do reduce your cholesterol, the better they work. But if you just take it and your cholesterol doesn't change one single iota, you still reduce your chances of having a heart attack, particularly if you've already had a heart attack, by about 20%. And so that's kind of interesting. You know, it's a drug that works, and it's been a huge, huge success for the care and treatment of patients with heart disease, kind of regardless of what it does to your lipids. Now, the caveat here is the more it does to reduce, the better the effect is. So there's an interesting relationship there. But the other funny thing is other drugs that have been developed to reduce cholesterol have not shown that same benefit. And again, this is another study where they prescribe it to people at risk, and it does reduce the cholesterol. The million-dollar question with this, and when I say $1 million, I'm not being metaphoric here. This is a very expensive question, is does it reduce heart attacks, which is really what anybody cares about. The trick with all this is, and I think the hardest thing about doing this type of research in science is, cholesterol is what we call a surrogate outcome. What does that mean? Well, a surrogate outcome is something we use as physicians to kind of test to see, to kind of measure the impact of disease. So another perfectly good example is blood pressure. You go to the doctor's office, you always get your blood pressure measured, and the measurement of your blood pressure is a way to say, kind of in our minds, stratify you as being higher or lower risk for having heart disease. Blood pressure by itself is not the issue. It's just that fact that we know the higher your blood pressure is, again, the more likely you are to have a heart attack. And we know that treating it with certain medicines reduces the chances of you having a heart attack. That being said, there's other treatments for blood pressure that may not have that same benefit. And so we have to be very careful. And the million-dollar question with this is really, does this reduce heart attacks, which is what we're trying to prevent when we give you any kind of medicine related to your heart, blood pressure, statins and aspirin, et cetera, et cetera.
And this is a non-statin?
This is a non-statin, yeah. These are newer drugs. I mean, there's no new statins coming out. They're pretty well established. You know, again, atorvastatin, which is still called Lipitor, but it's generic, is probably one of the most common ones prescribed. Very, very effective. It's always kind of my first go-to when I see patients with this.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a slew care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Another new study this past week came out for ultra marathoners about the electrolytes that they drink. It doesn't help as much as they may think.
A new study in the Clinical Journal of Sports Medicine finds that electrolyte supplements don't work to keep the body's essential sodium levels balanced. The result can be cramping and nausea and seizure and death in extreme cases. The study's lead author, ultramarathoner Dr. Grant Lipman, recommends hydration and salty snacks.
I personally like potato chips. There's nice fat content, calories to energize my run, and a good salt load, because if just drinking water or just drinking electrolytes, that's not going to protect you from potential injury from low salt.
Bud Mishkin, CBS News.
What do you think of that?
I think it's interesting. Always important to note, and this is kind of a little bit of medical speak, so salt, when we talk about that in the body, really doctors are talking about water. So salt follows water everywhere, and so our kidneys, which is the main regulator of our water balance in our body, basically uses salt, moving it in and out of your urine, so to speak, in order to regulate water. So if you imagine you're in the middle of a desert, you're thirsty, you haven't had access to water in a long time, and you had to urinate, your urine will be really dark and concentrated. And what that really is your kidney absorbing as much water as possible. So that's obviously an extreme condition. You know, ultramarathon is another extreme condition where, you know, people are exerting a lot of physical activity over a long period of time, and you're sweating and your muscles are consuming, you know, energy, amongst other things. You tend to lose water. And it's been a long-standing question of how you best hydrate or replenish that water. So Gatorade, that came out in the 60s or 70s, I don't know exactly when, really was designed to help enhance the absorption of not just water, but electrolytes to athletes. But as we have this more extreme conditions, and these people doing these very, very long marathons, it's just kind of the extreme limit of our physiology. And, you know, trying to correct that is challenging and difficult and kind of always a longstanding thing. I always joke, one of my chiefs will probably punch me later today for this comment, but if you actually look back at the story of the marathon, it was the Greeks fought a battle, I think, against the Persians, and then one of the soldiers after fighting ran 26.2 miles back to Athens to declare victory and then died. So, you know, not saying that running a marathon isn't that unhealthy, but it does tend to get us to the extremes of our physiology, and that can cause problems. And, you know, I think an important part about the study is when your body is saying things, you're starting to cramp or really reaching that fatigue, or, you know, in extreme situations, you have people that, you know, get confused and could certainly have seizures. You know, certainly you hope people listen to that. And it's just a sign that you're not, may not be your day to complete this type of training or race. And it's an important time. That's an important time to stop and you know, get yourself rehydrated and get kind of find that balance again.
So what's your advice to runners about rehydrating?
Well, again, I think what the study leader said in this is true is, you know, clearly need water, and then you need to replace those nutrients again with some kind of snack. And again, I am a sucker for potato chips as well. But I think it's really more you have to build up that endurance and then just kind of maintain that hydration. And pretty much anything is good. And good old water, it's been around for, you know, ever. And it's part of our physiology. And, you know, that certainly is kind of the base of things, in my opinion.
Dr. Buchholz, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks, Fred. Always happy to do it.
Dr. Fred Buchholz is a slew care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up, we'll talk with the former chief medical officer for Homeland Security, who's now the chief medical officer at SSM Health, about the coronavirus outbreak. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. The coronavirus outbreak is blamed now for killing about 3,000 people worldwide. There have been about 60 cases reported in the United States. Here to talk with us about that is Dr. Alexander Garza. Dr. Garza is the chief medical officer for SSM Health. Before that, he served as the chief medical officer for Homeland Security. Dr. Garza, thanks a lot for joining us.
Happy to be with you, Fred.
So we've had a lot of talk this past week about coronavirus. Lots of questions, not a lot of answers. Wanted to go over some of the basic questions with you about coronavirus again. First off, what is coronavirus?
Coronavirus, it's actually a family of viruses. So the one that we're talking about from the epidemic that's occurring is the novel coronavirus, which has been termed COVID-19. So it comes from a family of coronaviruses, some of which circulate amongst the human population, causing really common colds, things like that. There's other coronaviruses that live in the animal kingdom as well, and that's probably where this one originated from, although nobody knows quite yet where this came from or how it was transmitted to humans.
And how does it transmit?
Well, we believe it is just like any other respiratory virus. It's mostly through droplets. And so people that cough or sneeze or even breathe, that can expel some of the virus onto surfaces or onto other people. And that's how it's transmitted, most likely. If it follows the pattern of other respiratory viruses, that's the most likely mode of transmission.
What are the symptoms?
So the symptoms are just like any other respiratory virus. It's running a fever, although there's now case reports of people being asymptomatic, which means you don't have any symptoms at all and still being infected. But typically, if you do show signs of the infection, it's running a fever, it's having a cough, some shortness of breath, things that you would typically find in a viral respiratory infection.
And when would you decide that, hey, this is pretty bad, I need to see a doctor, this might be coronavirus? What's the key here?
Well, I think the key really is, are you reasonably at risk for contracting the coronavirus? So even though there has been an uptick in transmission, even outside of China, so in South Korea, in Italy, the risk to the United States has still remained low. And so you have to ask yourself, have I been in a situation where I could be considered at high risk for contracting the virus, such as did you recently come back from travel from Europe, particularly Italy? Were you spending time in China, or have you been around somebody that did that travel that was ill as well? Now, that's going to become more and more opaque as time goes on and more cases spread throughout the world. And now we're hearing stories of patients showing up in hospitals that have no known association with any of the in those countries or risk factors for coronavirus. So it's sort of entering this new phase now where it's not just, have you been to China? It's, are you displaying these symptoms? Does your story sound consistent with coronavirus? But really, in answer to your question, I think it's still dependent upon really how do you feel. So the coronavirus, by and large, doesn't cause serious illness in the majority of people that it infects. It still, you know, will give you the symptoms of a common cold, especially if, you know, young, otherwise healthy. And so if that is your case, then I would suggest do what you do for any other common cold, which is, you know, stay home from work, make sure you know you're coughing into your sleeve, practice good hygiene, all of those other things that you would do with any other respiratory illness. If you're feeling worse, you know, feeling short of breath, running really high fevers, things like that, then that's the time that you should seek out medical treatment.
And again, doctor, who is most at risk?
So the patients that seem to be most at risk for mortality from the coronavirus are people that are older and people that have chronic medical conditions. And so things like diabetes, high blood pressure, things like that. And really, that's consistent with other viral illnesses as well. So people that have compromised immune systems, such as older people or people with chronic diseases, are going to be susceptible to really most viral illnesses. So it is sort of fitting that pattern of how viruses attack humans.
We're talking with Dr. Alexander Garza. He's the chief medical officer for SSM Health. Dr. Garza, what is the fatality rate for coronavirus so far?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's still up in the air. And so the reason why I say that is in order to really establish a good mortality rate for any disease, not just this one, is you have to really know how many cases that you have. And so one of the challenges is how many people were actually infected by the coronavirus. So if you think about the situation going on in China, the people that were tested were probably those that were most sick or people at hospitals. Now, if you're one of those people that caught the virus but had mild symptoms, you probably stayed away from the hospital and never got tested. So you have to understand that we don't really know what the denominator is. But based on the data from the WHO and from the CDC, the mortality rate seems to be hovering around 2% of known cases, which is higher than the annual flu mortality, but still much lower than other coronavirus outbreaks that we've had, such as the SARS epidemic and the Middle East respiratory syndrome.
Do you have a feeling that the media is overhyping this, or is this as bad as you hear in the media?
I don't believe that it's really a delicate balance that you walk, and I feel the media is trying to walk this as well. So in some instances, this is a major issue. It is a novel virus. There is no immunity in the population. It is causing deaths around the world. And so it's a considerable viral outbreak. The second piece to that, though, that I think is equally important is the ramifications of the disease as well. And so that's what you're seeing in the economic sector. So the markets going down ever since, you know, this really became a substantial outbreak are sort of those second and third order effects. So and so when it starts impacting sort of other things in the world, so it's not just necessarily a health story now. Now it's a health story that is impacting infrastructure. It's impacting economically. It's impacting air travel, all of those things. And so then it becomes, you know, a bigger media story. I think where we need to exercise some caution, though, is evaluating risk to the individual. So as I said previously, we're still at low risk for contracting contracting the coronavirus in the United States. Now that may change, but the vast majority of people as well, even though it has that 2% mortality rate, the vast majority of people will most likely have a mild illness. It's trying to message to people that yes, this is a serious thing and we need to be prepared, but without creating undue anxiety or trying to overinflate, you know, what the issues really are.
So how should we prepare here?
That's a great question. I think there's a couple of different things that, you know, you need to think about when you're doing the preparation. So myself, as a chief medical officer for a healthcare system, we certainly have to do our preparations to make sure that we can take care of patients and protect our workforce should this become a larger outbreak. But what individuals can do are exactly what we would do, say, for instance, in a bad flu season, which is, you know, make sure you're staying home if you're sick, making sure that you relatively isolate yourself from other people so you can limit spread, washing your hands a lot. For if this does start impacting society, and when I say that, I mean, you know, if there's a lot of social distancing procedures going on, like in Japan, they shut the schools down, which again has all of those ripple effects. So if your kids are home, you have to be able to take care of them. You know, you have job responsibilities, making sure that you have enough medication, food, water, all of those things, if there are other disruptions, you know, within society. But really, I think the main things to focus on are all of those simple things that we should be doing with any respiratory illness, which is, you know, staying home if you're sick, washing your hands a lot, taking care of yourself, all of those little things.
Dr. Garza, stay with us. We're going to take a short break and then come back with some more questions about the coronavirus. We're talking with Dr. Alexander Garza. He's the chief medical officer for SSM Health. Previously, he was the chief medical officer for Homeland Security. This is Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. We've been talking with Dr. Alexander Garza. Dr. Garza is the Chief Medical Officer for SSM Health. Before that, he served as the Chief Medical Officer for Homeland Security. Dr. Garza, a lot of people I know are asking, what should I do to get ready when the coronavirus outbreak hits here in the United States? Should they go out and buy extra supplies of things?
I generally refer people to FEMA guidelines so this is a little bit of a different disaster than you would typically find sort of in a hurricane, tornado, sort of the things we typically think of as disasters. And the way that I sort of define them is those are really fast moving disasters. They come in, they do damage, and then they sort of go away, and then you have the response. This is a really slow-moving potential disaster because it's not an outbreak on the U.S. yet that could last for a prolonged period of time. It's a different way of thinking about this. So now you're thinking about, I need to make sure my supplies, so I'm talking now from a healthcare executive standpoint and from, you know, the experience at Homeland Security is making sure we have enough medicine, equipment, supplies so that we can help the healthcare sector continue their operations, that we can provide guidance to other critical assets within the United States to make sure they can continue operations. So remember, it's not just all about healthcare. We still want to make sure that we can keep the lights on, that we can keep the telephones working, that we can keep society running. And so those are different things that we focus on as well. And so in our disaster plannings, there's different plans built out for each of them and different things that we should be focusing on to make sure that they can continue to operate so that the impact felt by the American public is minimized.
The CDC says it's not a question of if, but when there is an American outbreak. In that case, are you concerned about the prescription medicine supply in the United States?
Maybe not so much the prescription medicine supply. And the reason why I say that, and I want to make sure I'm answering your question correctly. So the prescription medicine supply would really come from, you know, the pharmaceutical industry. And so making sure that we're able, again, to stabilize that industry so that they can continue to operate so that there isn't any interruption in supply. That's an important thing that we need to focus on. If you're talking about, for instance, during the H1N1 pandemic, we started running shortages on antiviral medication that's used to treat influenza. And so we had to make sure that supply of medications that we dipped into the stockpile, the strategic national stockpile, could distribute that to communities that needed it,
and made sure that we were able to replenish those supplies. And so that's really what that strategic national stockpile is for, is to supplement the state and local health systems to ensure that they can continue operations.
The United States imports a lot of medicine, over-the-counter drugs, from China. I think 95% of ibuprofen, 70% of acetaminophen comes from China. Any fear of us coming up short on that?
I don't know exactly how much it's impacting the pharmaceutical industry in China, so I can't give you a precise answer on that. Certainly, if it is impacting their workforce, where they're not able to keep up with production, you could see a slowdown in availability of particular materials. And so it's not just in pharmaceuticals, but really with anything that is primarily or substantially made in China. And that's part of the economic impact that we're feeling right now, is if your supply chain is heavily dependent upon China, then you're going to have problems getting those materials into the factories to build things and produce things. If we're primarily dependent upon China for some pharmaceuticals as well, I think it's reasonable to expect that there could be a slowdown. Now, how much that will affect, what's on the shelf at Walmart is really hard to predict, because we don't know, like, how much do we have in warehouses right now, how much production capacity has been impacted, things like that. But it's certainly a possibility.
I get a lot of questions from listeners about the coronavirus. One of the biggest ones I'm getting now is, should I buy and wear a face mask?
At this time, no. So as I said previously, the risk is low in the United States. There's very limited benefit with wearing a face mask at this time. Now, this story seems to change daily, almost hourly. And so, you could see a point where that could become a recommendation. But the other piece with that is understanding what your individual risk is for being exposed to the coronavirus. And so, for instance, a healthcare worker in the emergency department has a much higher risk of being exposed to somebody, not just with the coronavirus, but with influenza or tuberculosis or anything else. And so their needs for wearing a protective mask are much greater than an individual that has really limited exposure to people that might be at risk for carrying the coronavirus. And so I think, part of it is decreasing anxiety. So people will wear masks just to decrease that anxiety, or they feel more protected. But from a risk standpoint, it would be difficult for me to recommend that at this time.
Another question from a listener. If you've got the flu shot, does that help protect you at all?
Two different types of viruses. So the influenza virus and the coronavirus. So the influenza vaccine is built specifically to combat the influenza virus and not for the coronavirus. So the key to the vaccine, of course, is to build antibodies. And antibodies are very specific to the type of virus, which is why sometimes when you mismatch the influenza vaccine with what's circulating in the community, you don't have the immunity to it. So same principle. It has to be very specific to the virus.
The CDC says that when coronavirus begins spreading in the United States, our lives will be disrupted. What do you think that means?
I believe what the CDC is saying is, take China as an example, although I think they're more of an extreme example than what would occur in the United States. When you have a naive population, by naive I mean there's no immunity in the population, so it makes it easier for that virus to spread because it has a lot of now hosts that aren't able to combat it. So that's going to spread throughout the population, And we have to remember who makes up the population. So it's the things I spoke about earlier. It's people that keep the lights on. It's keep people that keep the cell phone towers working. It's people that stock grocery stores. And so we should be planning for what can we do to keep those industries up and running so that there's minimal impact. Now, some of the other things that you think of when you're planning for pandemics like this is doing what's really centuries-old procedures, which is what it's called social isolation, which is how do we keep people away from each other to really decrease the transmission of the virus. And so that's things like Japan is doing right now with canceling school. So what they're trying to do is keep people from clustering together to really slow down that transmission. And so it could be things like, hey, you know, we're not going to have a sporting event tonight, or we're not going to have, you know, that parade that we had scheduled having, or, you know, we're not going to have large group meetings anymore, or half of our workforce is going to now work from home in order to prevent the clustering of people. So it's all of those things that that together are designed to decrease the transmission of the virus that could impact society, as well as people just becoming sick and not able to perform daily functions.
Dr. Garza, thanks so much for your time. Really do appreciate it.
Anytime, Fred.
Dr. Alexander Garza is the chief medical officer for SSM Health. Before that, he served as the chief medical officer for Homeland Security. When we come back, we'll talk about accidental poisonings in the home of kids. We have a special warning for parents and grandparents. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. A new study finds adults unintentionally are making it easy for young children to eat and swallow dangerous pills. Here to talk with us about that is Julie Weber. Julie is the director of the Missouri Poison Center at SSM Health, Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Julie, good to talk to you again.
Thank you for having me. Great to be back.
So what's the scenario for this happening?
So what's frequently happening are that adults are removing medications, prescription medications that are in child-resistant packaging and using pill planners or another device that children have easy access to and could get in and take the medication.
What medications are being taken most often?
Most often, what we're seeing here in Missouri, actually, is that we're seeing like pain medications being taken. Within this study, though, there's all types of medications that were reported. Mostly, though, it was anticonvulsants. That's a medication used to stop seizures. Another medication is something to lower the blood sugar, and those for children can be extremely dangerous because just one tablet of certain medications for diabetes can actually be life-threatening for the child. And then that third top on their list was cardiovascular medicine, so something for the blood pressure or the heart.
Yeah, this just wasn't parents making this mistake. It was grandparents as well?
Yes, it's all ages that do this, but it's usually an adult taking it out of a child-resistant packaging.
So what suggestions do you have for parents and grandparents?
What we really want to caution parents and grandparents about are really to not use those pill planners. And I know they're helpful, but you can't use the ones that are easy to flip open and just that a child can easily open and get access to the medication. If you are going to use something like that, it maybe needs to be in a lockbox so it's out of the sight and reach of the child. Or even there are certain devices that have like a combination or some type of other lock on it that doesn't allow them just to flip up those lids.
What about taking the medication out of those child-resistant bottles?
So those child-resistant bottles, we really do support the use of those. And I really have over the years, there's two incidents that I've seen that have really this, it was a Poison Prevention Packaging Act way back in the 1970s. And the institution of that really did decrease childhood fatalities related to medications. And so we just, our message is you really do need to use those containers. And the big thing to remember is it does slow the child down, but it isn't poison or proof. So it's good to keep it in there, and it's also good to have things up high and out of their sight.
So what should you do if you think your child has taken a pill?
So what we do is we say immediately call the Poison Help Hotline. It's 1-800-222-1222, and one of our specially trained nurses or pharmacists will be able to help that caregiver decide what's happened and what we need to do. What's good to remember is if you just think the child ingested one, call, because what we're trying to do is prevent that unnecessary trip to the emergency department, and we're able to work with that caregiver and watch for symptoms and keep that child at home, and then we know there's going to be safety with follow-up calls.
Do you get a lot of these calls?
Actually, we really do. I don't have an exact number. It's a difficult one to track from child-resistant packaging. But even just recently speaking with our medical director, she's like, if I could get rid of those pill planners, they really do lead to an incidence of children getting into the medications.
We're talking with Julie Weber. She's director of the Missouri Poison Center at SSM Health Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital, about a new study that came out showing adults unintentionally are making it easy for young children to swallow dangerous pills. What other advice do you have for parents and grandparents?
Well, the advice I always say, too, is if possible, don't take medication in front of children. It really teaches them a habit that we have to do, and it's something often they want to imitate adults and be like them. And so we really say if you're going to do that, to really take your medicine not when they're in the room. And then something we often do is want to keep it in our sight, our medicine, so we don't forget to take our next dose. But again, it really needs to be in the cabinet, up high and locked if possible, or even just to really keep that child, maybe the medications away from that child by putting them away as soon as we're finished. Often, too, someone will put down the medication bottle with the lid open and lean over the sink to get a cup of water. And that quickly, little hands can grab that bottle and put it up to their mouth.
Julie, other than accidental ingestion of pills by kids, what are some of the most frequent calls you're getting these days at the Missouri Poison Center?
So some of the more frequent calls that we're getting are really, too, I saw vitamins. And vitamins really are attractive to the children now these days with the gummy formulations and the chewables that sometimes look like chocolate or other things. So that's something that's really high on the list. But in this category of children 5 and under, in our top 5 fall substances such as foreign bodies, which are toys and miscellaneous items. And under the toys, and miscellaneous, we have button batteries that fall into there. And I'm really talking more and more about the risk for button batteries, especially those lithium ones that are anywhere about, a size of a nickel can be a problem, but quarter especially, because they can get lodged into the throat and really cause no symptoms, maybe a little pain, but they can cause a burn very quickly and erode into the esophagus.
So what should we do about those?
So if there's any suspicion, we do advise to call still, and then we can refer you to the nearest facility. And then what we do is contact that hospital ahead of time, give our treatment recommendations, which is immediately to get a localization x-ray, and then we determine if that battery needs to be removed urgently.
I imagine some people get scared of calling because they fear they're going to get in trouble for allowing something to happen. Dispel that notion.
Really, we do not. All calls are confidential, and we actually compliment and really give kudos to family members who call because they realize something's happening and they're taking that next step to prevent something worse from happening. We are not an agency that reports to anyone, and we get the child into the best care if necessary, and everything remains confidential with us.
Any internet challenges out there that are kind of scary for you to hear about or see?
You know, just the other day, there was another internet challenge I heard about. One of our specialists on the hotline was mentioning, and it's with caffeine and the small bottles. And there could be thousands of milligrams of caffeine in a liquid drop. So that's something to watch about. Those challenges are just so dangerous. And caffeine is a drug, and it can cause serious problems of, might start out with just simple nausea or vomiting, but it can lead to seizures and an event with the heart. So really, those challenges are just continuing to be a problem. And actually, something to go to our website about, our next trending topic to be released is going to address all the different challenges that are out there and that we really need to watch out for.
Julie, thanks a lot. Before we let you go, run the number by us again that people need to keep in mind, keep up on the refrigerator.
It's 1-800-222-1222.
Julie, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Julie Weber is the director of the Missouri Poison Center at SSM Health Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. If you want to hear parts of this show again, please log on to KMOX.com and look under the podcast section. Or you can download the radio.com app and favorite KMOX. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Please join us again next week at the same time for another edition of Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.